founding director of Black Women in Church and Society. She earned her PhD in systematic theology at Union Theological Seminary. She has many publications to her credit. She has a book that has just come off the press, White Women's Christ and Black Women's Jesus. It is not yet in a bookstore in the Boston area, but after today, we make a few phone calls, we know those books will be available. I'd like to say something particular about Jacqueline. Her work for me has been water in the desert. She is solid, gentle, and caring, and wise. When I was a Master of Divinity student, I made a phone call to Atlanta, and even though she barely remembered me, she talked to me for about an hour around my nervousness at presenting at publishing my first paper. Her gentleness and wisdom at that time I've been able to engage that over and over again as I forge ahead in making my own theological path. So the wisdom that has been so precious and wonderful for me now comes to all of us in the person of Dr. Jacqueline Grant.
It is indeed good to be here with you. I can only repeat what has been said so many times already, to see so many faces that I have not seen in years, to rekindle friendship and to make new friends. So it's good to be in your company, and I appreciate the opportunity to share with you. This presentation you may find at the end is a cyclical presentation. That is, it's a process that I've been going through. It's a process that's been necessary for me as a theologian, as a womanist theologian. And therefore, even though in the end you may find that there is no substantive or radically new material, the process is what's been redemptive, I think, for me. A well-known theologian once warned us of answering questions that no one is asking. But Christian theology, he argued, ought to correlate the questions emerging out of the human situation with the answers as they are found in the gospel message. I believe that a theologian's accountability ought to be to the community of believers, which provide the raw data for theological reflections. However, I equally believe that accountability does not necessarily imply non-critical acceptance of the contents of any particular human situation. That is, there must be a self-critical or evaluative dimension to theology. And in fact, theology must not only be reflections upon the lived realities of the faithful, but it must also be prophetic. That is, it must raise the critical and sometimes difficult questions which arise out of various contradictions of life. Many contradictions stared me in the face a few years ago when I was in the midst of the dissertation process. That study, which was a comparative analysis of Black women's and white women's religious experiences and experiences particularly of Jesus Christ, led me to exploring the lived realities of Black women and white women. One theme that constantly emerged was that of servanthood. The theme was intriguing because it was often used to describe the role that women played in patriarchal societies. White women were challenging the relegation of themselves to the level of servants of men. This caused me to want to explore the lives of the servants of the servants. Black women, that is, Black women. It was clear that one of the best entrees for comparing the lives of white and Black women was through the study of domestic service. It is said that confession is indeed good for the soul. Let me therefore confess my problem at the time I was doing this research. My problem was essentially, given the nature of Black women's servitude, servanthood, I found it difficult to settle for the use of such terminologies to describe relationship with God. And therefore, I was wrestling with what to do with that. So I discussed it, as Beth Harrison just came in. We had this dialogue many times about what to do with this uncomfortable feeling that I was having with this theme. I talked with two black male theologians, and they listened to me and talked with me and agreed that it was a difficult subject, and both suggested that I go back to the tradition. And of course, my own sensibilities as well sent me back to the tradition as well. And I must be honest in saying that my initial proposal at that time was to move with the theme and to suggest that perhaps the problem with the use of the terminology, that perhaps the solution to the problem was the elimination of the use of the term servant in terms of describing the Christian reality. Well, I pursued my research, and I might also incidentally say that I ended up dropping a section from the dissertation because I couldn't work with it at that time. I wasn't prepared to go where I wanted to go with it. I continued the research and looked at a couple of moderate feminist perspectives on the issue. And let me share briefly two perspectives and move on. In explicating her position that Jesus is the representative for all, Letty Russell draws upon traditional words such as Jesus is Lord, Kyrios, and servant, diakonos. Finding no problem with either of these terms, she emphasizes in her discussion that these functions are necessary. Recognizing the possible objection to the use of such metaphors as servant and Lord, Russell is quick to refer to the true meaning of servant, Lord, and lordship. Servant and Lord are defined not as the titles for oppressed and oppressors or inferior or superior persons, which they have come to mean in our unjust and oppressive church and society, but in the sense of one divine oikonomia. In this sense, she does not only speak of the scandal of particularity as discussed, as she discusses early in her work, but also the scandal involved in using the word servant and Lord together. The question is not how can the male be God, but how can the servant be Lord? The answer rests in Jesus' proclamation that he came not to be served, but to serve. In the biblical sense, God is both Lord and servant. Consequently, Jesus is characterized in lordship and servanthood. Neither Lord nor servant can be removed from our description of God's self-presentation. The key to understanding them is to allow them to remain together in the liberating paradox that witnesses to the story of God's oikonomia. The words cannot be separated if they are to be understood without leading to false dualism and false use of power. The meaning of God's lordship is Jesus Christ, in Jesus Christ is clear only in relation to the purpose of the lordship which is service. The purpose of God's service and subordination in Jesus is to establish the lordship of God. Looking at the same theme, Rosemary Ruther articulates a liberation approach to Christology when she proposes a question, can Christology be liberated from the encapsulation in the structures of patriarchy and really become an expression of liberation of women? Ruther deals with two concepts. The concept of service and conversion. And what she argues is that service must not be confused with servitude. In her view, service implies autonomy and power used in behalf of others. We're all called to service. Our conversion is to accept this call by abandoning previous inaccurate notions of being called to hierarchical and oppressive leadership and power. We are then called to a new Christology, which leads us to a new humanity of wholeness in mutuality. Well, both of these thinkers have provided reformulations which are helpful in making somewhat palatable a traditional Christian concept which is distasteful, to say the least. As I examined my discomfort with these, I felt that perhaps my problem was with the ease with which some Christians speak of such terms as service and servants, particularly those who represent the dominant race and culture of our societies and our churches. Perhaps my discomfort stemmed from the experience, knowledge of the Black community vis-a-vis service, and particularly the Black woman as related to domestic service. The people's, Black people's, and Black women's lives demonstrate to us that some people are indeed more servant than others. Studies in the area of Black women's work, domestic service, I think, demonstrate what I mean. The abolition of slavery left intact the basic relationship between Black women and white women in particular, and Black people and white people in general. For some, emancipation meant slavery without chains, and for others, mere servanthood. Post-slavery brought neither change in image nor significant change in the conditions of Black people in the United States. The image was still that Blacks were inferior and that they were intended to serve, to service white America. Consequently, when Blacks, now free, sought work, they were relegated to service jobs and menial work, which they did forcibly during slavery. For Black men, this meant plantation or farm work, factory work, eventually other service-oriented work, and then no work at all. For many Black women, this meant sharing some of the work that Black men did, as well as making up significant percentages of domestic servants in this country. Studies in domestic servants show that Black women are more often in this category than any other group of people. Between 1890 and 1920, while white female servants decreased, Black female servants increased, and by 1920, 40% of all domestic servants were Black women. 70% of all laundresses were Black. Disproportionate numbers of Black women were permanently relegated to domestic servants. This was because Black and servant, especially in the South, were considered synonymous. Katzman described the domestic service in the South as a caste system. Comparing the South with the North and West, he notes that servants were rarely found in lower middle class or working class families. However, in the former slave states, Black servants were equally common in households headed by wage earners as in those headed by white collar workers. He further notes that the South has been called a housewife's utopia. This system in the South was a part of the larger racial caste structure in which, reminiscent of slavery, Blacks were servants and whites were masters, and never the two should be changed. The domination-subordination relationship within the household mirrored the white-Black relationship in general, and especially in the South. Though legal slavery was abolished, much of the character of slavery remained for decades thereafter. This meant that basic relationships had not changed significantly, as we see in various areas of Black life. Though whites were not always able to use individual physical violence as measures of direct control and obedience, violence became incorporated as a basic program of such groups as the Ku Klux Klan and later recognized law enforcement agencies under the guise of law and order. In the private family world, we are able to note the continuation of many of the oppressive practices of slavery. Servants were often engaged for work with little or no guarantee that they would be paid. When they were paid, it was often slave wages, that is, little pay for a great deal of work. Baker and Cook, in their study, The Bronx Slave Market, uncovers the who, what, and why and when of Northern servitude at its worst. in the Bronx, a northern borough of New York City known for its heavy Jewish population, exists a street corner market for domestic servants where Negro women are rented, quote unquote, at unbelievably low rates for housework. Unlike the slave auction, buyers were primarily women, and they negotiated directly with the workers. But like the slave auctions, workers still got the short end of the stick. Rain or shine, cold or hot, you would find them there. Negro women, old and young, sometimes bedraggled, sometimes neatly dressed, but with the invariable paper bundle, waiting expectantly for Bronx housewives to buy their strength and energy for an hour, 2 hours, or even for a day at a low rate of 15, 20, 25, or if luck were there, 30 cents an hour. The relationship between white women and their black women servants is depicted in two literary studies by two black women, one of whom had personal experience as a domestic servant. Unable to find employment as an actress, Alice Childress, as many educated black women have, found herself doing domestic work, a means of surviving. Based on her experience, she wrote a book entitled Like One of the Family, in which she employed wit to expose many lingering beliefs of white women about black women. In spite of the fact that white women brought black women into their homes to raise their children and clean their homes, they, white women, held that black women were dirty, diseased, and dishonest. Consequently, black women found themselves being asked for health cards to verify health status, and they also found monies laid in strange and unexpected places to test their honesty. She tells a story of her mistress asking for a health card one day, and she came back and asked the mistress for her health card. Trudia Harris, in From Mammy to Militant, combines folkloristic, sociological, historical, and psychological analysis with the literary ones to argue that power relationships inherent in the concept of place, that blacks are always inferior to whites, provide the initial forces in which to view the interactions between black women and their adoptive families. Harris goes on with much data that really describes the relationship between black women and white women and the power relationship, the power struggles as well. Though legally emancipated, servants were still essentially treated as property. The life of servants was almost as controlled as it was during slavery. Still under the conditions of servitude, black women and black people were considered subordinate property and not equal human beings in pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness. We could talk more about the stereotypes between black women and white women, but I'll move on given our time restraints. Of course, we could talk about the other stories of the economic exploitation, little pay or no pay. I recall my grandmother, for example, telling me of the time when she worked for 25 cents a week. There are stories of the sexual exploitations as well. I'll never forget the time that in my front yard, my father was raking the yards and burning leaves, and I came out and asked him, Daddy, can I get a job? I come from a working class family, perhaps lower working class, family that never had a lot of luxuries but always had what we needed. But I remembered I used to watch the other kids in school when they'd come to school with their new clothes and et cetera. And I wanted to be able to buy new clothes. I was coming from a family of 9 children. You don't get the opportunity to have new clothes very often. And so hand-me-down was the order of the day. And I recalled that I wanted to just be able to buy some new clothes. And I thought that it was really a good idea to offer myself to go and work. Well, my daddy said no. I said, why? He said, because. I forgot about that experience until I started doing this research on domestic service. When I became aware of what actually went on in these homes, the homes of mistresses, it suddenly that scene from my childhood experience suddenly stared me in the face. Jacqueline Jones, in her study of black women's work, black women's workers, indicated that in some areas of this country, domestic service was the only occupation, the only job available for black women. That was certainly true in my hometown, for if a black woman did not go to college to become certified to teach, the only thing she could do in Georgetown, South Carolina, was domestic service, except for those few, like my mother, who went to trade school and got training for to do hair, cosmetology. They were able to escape domestic service. Well, the dilemma for me is a theological one. How do you justify teaching a people that they are called to a life of service when they have been imprisoned by the most exploitative forms of service? To speak of service as empowerment without concrete means or plans for economic, social, and political revolution that in fact leads to that empowerment is simply another form of over-spiritualization. Furthermore, how do you propose that we are called to service to Jesus, the one who has been sent by God to redeem us when both God and Jesus have been principal weapons in the oppressive arsenal to keep blacks and black women in their appropriate places? Both God and Jesus were portrayed as white and male and interested primarily in preserving the white patriarchal status quo. In that vein, then, do we simply answer Bill Jones's question, yes, God is a white racist? Not only that, but he is also a male chauvinist pig, an irredeemable sexist. If we are unwilling or unable to accept this proposition, then how are the redeemers liberated from the oppressive structures of the oppressors? W.B. Du Bois is helpful, perhaps not in resolving the dilemma, but certainly in helping us to see more clearly. In articulating the spiritual strivings of black people, Du Bois speaks of a double consciousness of black people. He says, the Negro is a sort of seventh son, born with a veil and gifted with second sight in this American world, a world which yields him no true self-consciousness but only lets him see himself through the revelation of the other world. It is a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, this sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity. One ever feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in the one body, whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder. When I consider the two-ness or double nature of the black conscious, and in fact the triple nature of black women's consciousness, I am able to reconsider my old thesis, that is, the servanthood theme in Christianity needs to be eliminated from Christian theology, for it has outlived its usefulness. What we find instead is the capacity of blacks to live in two and sometimes more worlds at the same time. They understood that their relationship with the other world, the white world, was to be. Even when they did not accept it, they understood it nonetheless. Survival made this a necessity. For black people, the double consciousness meant that blacks, to some degree, function in the white world in terms defined by that white world. It is also the case that black people function in their own world based on their own self-understanding. This point was perhaps not adequately expressed by Du Bois, for blacks indeed did not always see themselves only through the eyes of white people. With this in mind, it is possible to understand the birth of the black church. It was a public declaration that our self-understanding takes precedence over the definition of the other world. In this context, we can truly be the servants of the living Christ. This brings me back then to my original problem regarding black women and servanthood. What sense does it make to rejoice in the service of a man who has been used not only to save but also to exploit? The triple consciousness of black women makes it possible to see how they were able to liberate redemption as they overtly and covertly challenged the assumptions of the racist and sexist status quo. That triple consciousness gave them the possibility of experiencing a liberating Jesus, even as they were given a racist and sexist one. It enabled me to better understand how black women relegated to domestic service could go to church on Tuesday and Wednesday nights and Sunday mornings and testify of being a better servant of the Lord and Savior Jesus. What they were saying was perhaps what the early church was saying to the Roman Empire when they professed Jesus as Christ, Jesus Christ as Lord. Or what Karl Barth and the others were saying when they gave their allegiance to Jesus rather than to Hitler. Or what the Southern Africans met when they were writing Kairos, the Kairos document, as they proclaimed a living and just God. Perhaps what these black women were saying is that what I am forced to do from Monday through Saturday is redemptive only in the sense that it facilitates survival. True redemption takes place when one experiences the Redeemer even as it is in the context of oppression. They're speaking of such titles as Lord and Master with regard to Jesus, and God meant that the lords and masters of the white world were illegitimate indeed. The church and religious experience of African Americans allow them the opportunity to express their spirituality freely, at least at a certain degree. For African American women, the third level of consciousness is accented as we consider the limitations placed upon women, even within the religious sphere of the black church or the African American church itself. This third consciousness level caused some women to challenge the church intensively and outside the church, or challenge the church internally, as well as it resulted in some folks leaving the church as well. When the Redeemer was liberated, black women were able to see themselves as servants of the Christ and not servants of the oppressive world. At a recent conference of religious women, Cheryl Gary Smith of the Black Women's Health Project helped the participants in revising an old song which was used as the theme of the conference. The words were, "We've come this far by faith, leaning on the Lord." It was revised to say, "We've come this far by faith, leaning on each other." I commented during my closing sermon at this conference that it's good to acknowledge that black women were able, even in midst of the chaos, to develop community and family under the harsh systems of oppression which worked against them, against the community and against family. Those communities and families were indeed redeeming, but the story does not end there. When they sang, "We've come this far by faith, leaning on the Lord," they were acknowledging a faith journey, the travelers on which were more than themselves. There was a Jesus to sustain them when the road got rough and the going got tough. It was Jesus that befriended Sojourner Truth when no one else could or would. It was Jesus that made Jerina Lee preach anyhow. In a more recent time, it was Jesus that provided guidance for Mary McLeod Bethune. It was Jesus that motivated the activist Fannie Lou Hamer. Black women were constantly liberating Jesus, as Jesus was liberating them. Where then is the dilemma? If I listen to black women's communities, I would say that the dilemma is at the point of having to live in two and sometimes three different worlds at the same time. Womanist theology is committed to bringing holism to their being. Being a servant of the Redeemer means joining the struggle of the Redeemer against oppression wherever it is found. Where is redemption? Redemption happens wherever the struggle for liberation is. Who is the Redeemer? The Redeemer comes to us through whoever engages in the redeeming struggle of liberation. Thank you.
Dr. Dolores Williams is an assistant professor of theology and culture at the Divinity School at Drew University. She is a poet, author, the mother of four children. She is a former director of the Anna Howard Shaw Center at Boston University School of Theology. And she has published in many publications, Christianity in Crisis, the book Immaculate and Powerful, the Journal of Feminist Studies in Religion, and there was one other, which I failed to mention, but I'm sorry. Weaving the Visions by Carol Crisp and Judith Plaskow. I'm sorry to make this so raggedy, but I've lost my purple sheet. What I want to say about Dolores is this, that I got introduced to her a couple of years ago by Dr. Cheryl Towson Jilks, and we have been friends ever since. But my most vivid experience of who this woman is as a theologian, a womanist theologian, happened in the American Academy of Religion a couple years ago when it met in Boston. And Dolores was on a panel with any number of other womanist theologians. And although people were paying very close attention to what everyone had to say, when Dolores spoke, the room stopped. Everybody listened. So I bring to you a woman who can, by her voice and her power, appear to make the earth stop moving. Come on up and share your wisdom with us.
You know, Imani Shiloh better be careful because I am not giving out the boons on Judgment Day. It is the dear Lord who's doing that. And let me say, first of all, the doctor is not doctor yet. With the defense of my dissertation, I will be. Today I want to talk about, and the earth does not stop when I move either. When I talk, maybe when I move. I'm going to talk today about poetic language, re-image and redemption are shading in the context. Now, all of that will be jumbled around and mixed together. I love for the audience to participate by way of the imagination in whatever I do. So I'm hoping that happens today. Now, as I understand it, we, the presenters, are to do theology. To do theology, as I myself understand it, is rather to do theology rather than to talk theologically about theology already done. This business of doing theology before you suggests to me an in-process activity whereby you see me wrestle with some questions about women and God, whereby you see me contort, gyrate, gesture, fuss, fragment, and finally resolve the matter in whatever comes up. Perhaps only more questions. Perhaps poems and parables. But always an uneasy feeling, an unsettling caused by what I know deep down in my bones. And that is, God is like a tumbleweed, moving lightly where God listeth, but grounding redemption in the nitty-gritty of history. in human bodies suffering because of what some authority willed, in human souls separated from each other because of a poverty of spirit, in human society defiling the earth because of greed and conquest. This thing of doing theology is a serious business. It begins, I think, when life pressures a Christian or a religious person to ponder a problem, and when the theologian steps forward to shape the question and to search for a response. So let us begin to do theology. Now, the problem for me comes from vestiges of the Afro-American Christian community, where the question is beginning to present itself, and that question is this: why have black women clung so tenaciously to Jesus of Nazareth as a redemptive symbol? Why? And does this pose a problem for black women's liberation? Now, there are many trajectories of black women's experience that I could explore to deal with this question, but I chose to review black women's historical experience with surrogacy in order to find out more about redemption. I keep in mind what I want us all to realize, and that is to do womanist theology, which is what I am doing, is to also do women's history, to shade in a context, to find a usable past so that we can construct a redemptive present. Now, it is possible, as far as my research has shown me, it is possible to identify two kinds of surrogacy that have negatively affected Afro-American women's lives. They are coerced surrogacy and voluntary surrogacy. Coerced surrogacy belongs to the antebellum period, to the time before the Great American War of Liberation in 1960. And it was a forced condition in which people and systems more powerful than black women and black people forced black women to function in roles that ordinarily would have been filled by someone else. For example, black female slaves were forced to substitute for the slave owner's wife in nurturing roles involving white children. Black women were forced to take the place of men in work roles that, according to the larger society's understanding of male and female roles, belonged to men. Frederick Law Olmsted, a Northern architect writing in the 19th century, said, he stood for a time watching slave women repair a road on a South Carolina plantation, indeed men's work. This coerced slave surrogacy was legally supported in the ownership rights by which slave masters controlled their property, black women. Slave women could not exercise the choice of refusing surrogacy roles. Then, after the end of the Great War of Liberation, the coercion associated with antebellum slavery surrogacy was replaced by social pressures that influenced, now remember I'm putting emphasis here on influenced, that influenced rather than coerced many black women to continue to fill some of the same surrogacy roles they had continued during slavery. But there was an important difference between antebellum surrogacy and postbellum surrogacy. The difference was, because of this element of choice, black women could determine a bit about their future, even though they were pressured, in some sense, to give up what would have been free choice in a supposedly free world. Now, let us take a look, if we can, at these two modes of surrogacy. That's antebellum surrogacy and voluntary surrogacy, and see where they lead us with regard to black women and redemptive faith. In the antebellum South, surrogacy roles involving black women were basically in three areas: in the area of nurturance, in the area of field labor, and in the area of sexuality. Some of the traditions associated with these three areas have helped develop stereotypical images of black women that have survived from antebellum time to the present. Now, one such tradition was that of the black slave mammy. Standing in the place of the slave owner's wife, mammy nurtured the entire white family. A long and respected tradition among Southern whites, mammy was an empowered but not autonomous house slave who was given considerable authority by her owners. According to the existing scattered reports of mammy and how the tradition operated, we know that many Southerners thought mammy could do about anything and do it better than anyone else. And because of her expertise in all domestic matters, she became the premier house servant and all others were her subordinates. Therefore, historian Deborah Gray White has concluded that Mammy was a woman dedicated, completely dedicated to the white family, especially to the children of that family. She was the house servant who was given complete charge of domestic management. She served also as a friend, an advisor. She was, in short, surrogate mistress and surrogate mother. However, historian Eugene Genovese, and I think he's right in this, makes the point that while mammies were devout in their care for white children, they were also just as dedicated in their care of their own families and in the well-being of black people. They often interceded to prohibit other slaves from receiving floggings and abuse, and they performed other services beneficial to the slave community. Then Genovese goes on to conclude that her tragedy lay not in her abandonment of her own people, but in her inability to offer her individual power and beauty to black people on terms they could accept without themselves sliding further into the system of paternalistic dependency. Though tenable, Genovese's observation forgets some black women who, beyond the plantation, bore the title of mammy, but who were subtly engaged in liberation efforts. One such woman, of course, was Mammy Pleasance. Early in her life, she had lived in Georgia, but a planter had recognized her intelligence and sent her to Boston to be educated. Here, according to W.E.B. Du Bois' account of her life, she was made a household drudge and eventually married. I don't know if there's a big connection meant to be made between that, but I guess some of us can speak for experience and say the two go together in some way. She inherited $50,000 from her husband's estate, and with this money, she migrated to California and made a fortune. Describing the liberation activity of Mammy Pleasance, Du Bois reported that she wanted her epitaph to read, "She was a friend to John Brown," and it was Mammy Pleasance who provided the money for John Brown's raid. And when she got to Harper's Ferry and found out that he had been hanged, she disguised herself as a jockey and went back into New York, got a boat, and came back around to California. But all that is to say that while the mammy role, while black women often work and officiate in roles that they have to, they often change these roles so that they benefit black people, especially in the area of liberation. The mammy role was probably, as much as my research has shown me with regard to this issue of coerced surrogacy during the antebellum period, the mammy role was probably the most powerful and authoritative one slave women could fill. And those Southern women in their coerced roles of mammy were often abused, and that is to be underscored, they were in a sense more empowered than the other slaves, especially those who worked in the fields. In the area of field labor, black women were forced to work usually associated with male roles. In the fields, slave women and men performed the same tasks. Black feminist scholar Bell Hooks claims that on large plantations, women plowed, planted, harvested crops. On some plantations, black women worked longer hours in the fields than black men. What this amounted to in terms of coerced surrogacy was black women's or black female energy substituting for male energy, standing in the place of males. This resulted in what Hooks refers to as the masculinization of the black females. And in some of the autobiographies that we have from ex-slave women, many of them attest to the fact that black women were forced into masculine roles during slavery to fill the gap when men were not on, numerous men were not on the plantation, and also just as part of the workforce on the plantation. It was an ex-slave, Bethany Veeney, who tells of helping her cruel slave master haul logs, drive out hogs, and set posts in the fields for fences. And Louisa Piquet, who told her story in 1861, mentioned that slave women drove ox for male energy, which field tasks were ordinarily thought to require. It may be that this was the root contributor to some male slaves' lack of gender distinction in their use of pronouns. Union Army officer Colonel Higginson related an experience illustrating the way slaves used pronouns. Higgins reported that, "I have asked many dusky attendants its meaning, that is a female custom, and have received the unfailing answer, framed with their usual indifference to the gender of pronouns, 'He,' meaning she, 'is in the Lonesome Valley, sir.'" And today, I might just add this, it may well be, in both the larger American society and in the Afro-American community, that the tendency to signify only masculinity when we use the words "the blacks" may derive in part from this early American practice of masculinizing black females through their work. Now, this focus upon coerced surrogacy roles of female slaves in the area of nurturance and in the area of field work reveals that also a class distinction, that women of the fields were not respected as much as mammies were, and women of the fields had double and triple duty to do, whereas mammies did not have that much to do in terms of going out of the house, working somewhere else for long hours, and then coming into the house and taking care of the family. That was not the job of mammy. There was the last kind of surrogacy that I want to talk about that was very true in antebellum times, and perhaps vestiges of it are alive today. That was the kind of coerced surrogacy that had to do with the sexuality of the female slave. And what that meant was that during the exploitation of the sexuality of the female slave, and what that meant was that during the antebellum period of the time before the Great War of Liberation, the Victorian model of true womanhood in terms of white women would spawn a consciousness that suggested that the real role of white women was merely to produce the offspring. She was to be rather sexless, pure, pedestalized, but certainly not an object for sexual pleasure. It was then the black woman to whom the slave master turned for his sexual pleasure. And in that sense, she became one who stood in the place of white women. And I make that claim on the basis of the fact that the kind of racism alive in the South at that time that was really against miscegenation, although miscegenation had happened, the kind of racism in the South has certainly prohibited the coming together sexually of white males and black women. But this did happen, and black women were totally exploited because they were, again, standing in the place of what the ideology of the South would identify as a white woman's place. And there were, of course, certain kinds of trade that happened that institutionalized the sexual liaison between white men and black women, and that was something called the fancy trade, in which women, black women who were thought to be beautiful black women, were raised for the purpose of being mistresses for rich white men, and they would come to places like the fancy ball that was given in the Octoroon Ball, it was called, in New Orleans, and select one of those women by her and take her back to be her mistress. Now, what my research has shown me, and I will not get as far into the postbellum business of voluntary surrogacy because of the time, but voluntary surrogacy in the postbellum time has meant that black women, while black women were freed in some sense by the Great War of Liberation, they still were not completely exempted from all surrogacy roles. And the two surrogacy roles in which they remained rather fixed, even though there were choices to be made, was the role of field laborer because of poverty, and the role of Mammy, although that changed when it serviced black people. There was, in fact, in 1910, a real effort in Albany, Georgia, to establish something called the Black Mammy Memorial Institute. And it was actually established. And the purpose of that, by the white citizens of the town, and a black man got the idea, the purpose of that institute, as it was given in the material that came from the Black Mammy Memorial Foundation, was to train black men and women, but especially, and I think this is significant for all of us as women to hear, but especially to train women in the role of motherhood. So there was, after slavery, they were still going to be trained in the way of motherhood as mammies had been mother. Now, what that does theologically, and here I think I'm skipping over some material because I want us to, I'm trying my best to take heed of this 10 minutes Iman has put on this floor here. What this does, of course, looking at the surrogacy as a important aspect of black women's historical experience, is to suggest certainly surrogacy has been a structure of domination in black women's lives. And it is this rather than race which makes black women's experience of oppression unique. Now, we share our experience of race with, now it doesn't mean that it erases racism, by no means. We share the experience of racism that black men and certain other groups of color share. We share with white women the experience of sexism that women of many and most groups share. But what we as black women have shared with each other is a special kind of oppression associated with the system of domination that surrogacy has been, and that is our unique oppression. Now we come to the original theological question. Why have black women through the ages clung so tenaciously to Jesus of Nazareth as a redemptive symbol? Certainly my journey through black women's history has shown me the importance and the identification, and has allowed me to identify the work and place of surrogacy in black women's lives. Now, this is the rub. Jesus is the ultimate surrogate figure for our redemption. And it was Jesus, we have been told in Christian teaching, it was Jesus who hung on the cross in our place. And it was in that sense that Jesus was the substitute for us all. In his life, then, was he a divine mammy, nurturing other people's children, giving them the sustenance they needed to stand between themselves and the cold, cold world? He miraculously fed other people's children with fishes and loaves. Like Mammy, Jesus knew all there was to know about his work of redemption. Jesus then became human to be made Mammy, reviled, rebuffed, laughed at, and finally dying in somebody else's place. But now some questions emerge here as far as black women's liberation is concerned. If we assume that black women's historical experience of surrogacy has something to do with their way of identifying with Jesus, does accepting the surrogate Lord as redemptive symbol make us black women passive to the oppressive operation of surrogacy in our lives? Make us oblivious to forces at work influencing us to stand in somebody else's place, to be at the beckon of somebody else's call, to forever service the needs and goals and tasks and responsibilities of somebody else? What about our unwed mother? Thus, if surrogacy through Jesus receives divine status, will black women consciously or unconsciously regard mammying, whether to white or black people as a route to salvation? And there are, of course, other Christological questions that this business of surrogacy causes us to ask. Given whatever Jesus' understanding of God was, given whatever Christians have been taught about God the Father's will in relation to the death of the Son, was Jesus' surrogacy coerced surrogacy, or voluntary surrogacy, or both? Well, I have no answers to these questions. I'm only the one who asks them. But I do make one claim, as I do theology before you, as I gyrate, as I flex, as I flinch. I do make one claim that some of us black feminists probably feel we have to make in regard to what we consider the theological task to be. Do we have the task then? Or must we take upon ourselves the task of re-imaging the image of redemption for our community? And my theological hunch is, and this is the statement and perhaps the rub, my theological hunch is that to re-image redemption is to re-image creation, and to re-image creation is to re-image relation. And this is where one part of my work, as I do theology before you, this is where one part of my work as doing theology, as the poet who does theology, it is at this point that the poetic language comes to play in the theology as I wrestle with the question I've just asked, do we need to re-image redemption by re-imaging creation? Something in my poetic soul has said, I think, yes to this. I want to read for you a parable of creation that I have done. And it's merely called Parable of Creation. God moved into the soul of dust. God and soul joined bodies and shaped a woman and a woman and a man and a man and a woman and a man. God and soul shaped them in merriment and joy. In the image of two bodies meeting, God and soul made a woman and a woman and a man and a man and a woman and a man. Creation drank spirit and breath between the holding of bodies and breaking. Woman and woman, man and man, woman and man. They became human form, fleshed with the skin, bone and sinew of touch. The earth, green and grafting, welcomed human form into its birth soil. A woman and a woman and a man and a man and a woman and a man. The seas clear and calm bathed them in the day of ages. Wind gifted them with the way of motion. Sun, moon, and stars gave them the vision of heights. Birds and creeping things endowed them with the way of utterance. A woman and a woman and a man and a man and a woman and a man. They taught each other the way of speech. A woman and a woman and a man and a man and a woman and a man. But man's word grew up between them. They forgot the image of two bodies meeting. They separated themselves from birth soil and clear seas and the gifting wind. They forgot the vision of heights and the source of utterance. They only remembered the word man made. They worshiped it. They sanctified it. They sacralized it. They reified it. They named it God. There was a creator. He was a man. He walked abroad and he met a girl. She was unformed, but in her eyes he saw a question. He communed with her at the level of the question. She liked it. He liked it. They said it was good. He communed with her in the deep places of her being conscious. She liked it. He liked it. They said it was good. He communed with her at the mountain of her body's need. Ah, she liked it. He liked it. They said it was good. In the acts of their communion, they discovered they made a woman. He taught her his life. He taught her his love. He taught her him. He taught her her. Then he who was the creator took her among the people and said, "This is my creation and she is beautiful." They said, "She is, she is, she is." But he who was the creator forgot to remember the predisposition of her who was created. He sent her among the sons of sons and the daughters of daughters. Among the sons of sons, she learned the bread and tears of laughter. They taught her the way of shifting forms. She grew shrewd in her saying. Among the daughters of daughters, she drank the wine of the wrath of their knowing. They taught her the way of her own predisposition. She grew proud in her knowing. One day she returned to the Creator when he was among the people. She rebuked him for dismembering the predisposition from herself who was created. His lesson she cast from her mind like demons from the demoniac. Their communion she spewed from her mouth in words, piercing his flesh with lightning. Their love she tore from her heart and cast into the ground like deep, dull holes in his being. Their life she broke into pebbles and flung into the whirlwind. He who was the creator turned his back on creation. Jesus wept. He was a man. She who was created returned to the sons of sons and the daughters of daughters. The sons of sons made war in words and became law in their own shrewd knowing. The daughters of daughters retreated and grew lax in their brave saying. She who was created gave her spirit to the hold of his power. Her speech lost its way and learned only to deceive itself. Inside her emptiness took life. She who was created lost all the way of creation. She felt her life explode. Distraught, she wandered in search of the Creator and found her among the people. She said to her, "Heal me." She who was the Creator looked at the creation. And oh, she loved her. She said, "Heal me." She said, "Not here." She said, "Heal me." She said, "Not here. There will be water. There will be blood. You will be vulnerable. I will be vulnerable. Not here." But creation screamed, "Heal me." She said, "Not in this place of death and destruction." She said, "Heal me." She said, "Not here, a common ground." She who was creator looked at the creation and, oh, she loved her. She who was created looked at the creator and, oh, she loved her. For at that moment, she taught her faith. I found God in myself one day, and I loved her fiercely. I found God one day inside myself, and I loved her fiercely. I found God one day outside myself in her, and I loved her fiercely. I found God one day outside myself in him, and I loved him fiercely. I found God one day in the baby in my womb, and I loved that child fiercely. I found God one day, and I loved fiercely.
We'd like to give both of our speakers, presenters, time to take a deep breath. We'd like to ask them to come up to the table in order to respond to your questions. I'd like to ask Jacqueline and Dolores to come up for the 10 minutes that we do have and to allow, at this point, 2 to 3 people to ask questions, and we must make the transition to the other building at 12:25. Open to questions and comments from those of you who are among us.
Yes, Professor Grant, I can see how your reconceptualization of Du Bois's double consciousness can incorporate two conceptions or two competing conceptions of servanthood, but I'm wondering, is it possible for, say, feminist theologians to have that kind of double consciousness in terms of accepting the conceptions of Lord in the Black community? I mean, there seems to be a real reluctance to embrace Christ as Lord, as opposed to Christ as fellow traveler, friend, fellow redemptor, that kind of thing.
In which community? Feminist community?
In the feminist community.
And so your question is, because of that reluctance, what?
Okay, my question is, in the feminist community, it seems that there's a real reluctance to embrace the notion of Christ as Lord, that I don't think is quite as present in the Black community. And I'm wondering, will this double consciousness come about in the feminist community as well, or is it something that you encourage or that you think is necessary?
Okay, I'm not sure how you're putting together the double consciousness with your comment about feminist understanding of lordship, but I can respond to both parts of it. I'm not sure how they're going to come together. But
okay.
It could be that I'm just not understanding what you're saying. In terms of the first part of the question, in terms of feminist understanding of the lordship of Christ, to be fair and accurate, I think we'd have to say that in some feminist communities, that in some feminist perspectives, you would find difficulty with the notion that Jesus Christ is the unique Lord or the only Lord. And for many feminists, the term unique is the operative term there, and that's where the objection is. You find in some circles, some feminist circles, there is the increasing acknowledgement that the Christ, the Lord, or the Christ, the Christic figure can appear in other forms, not just in Jesus centuries ago, but it can appear today as a sister, etc. So I think that you'd find varying perspectives within the feminist community with regard to the lordship question. The two perspectives that I talked about, there are some slight differences as well. In terms of Du Bois's double consciousness notion, I believe that really the principle can apply to any oppressed group. The principle of his double consciousness, I think, is basically that oppressed peoples, by nature, by virtue of what it means to be oppressed, tend to live in two different worlds. You live in the world of who you are by virtue of who you are created to be, and then you live for survival's sake. However, one must understand the world that is imposed upon your own reality. Therefore, when you look at the race, if you look at this in a racial context, Black people live in two worlds. They live in the Black world, and Black people live in a white world. And in order to survive, you got to have the understanding of the white world just as one has the understanding of the Black world. Well, I think the same principle can apply when we look at the gender analysis. Women, I believe, and I'm sure that some of the men might object to this, but women, I believe, by nature of what it means to be women in sexist societies, women tend to have to understand men in ways that men don't presume it necessary to understand women. Therefore, women, I would say, have an understanding of two worlds, the world of women and the world of men, and knowing the world of men is a basic principle of survival. You have to know that in a sexist society. So I comment on both parts of your question, but I'm not sure how we bring it together.
I don't want to belabor the point because I'm sure there might be other people, but my question really is, can the womanist savior be reconciled with a feminist savior? I mean, I hear, like Carter Haywood had a different focus in her Christology than you do. But double consciousness within the black community, within the black church, I think allows for different Christologies to exist side by side. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the feminist community and among feminist theologians, I see less of that. That's my own perception. It mm-hmm. might
well,
be an uninformed perception.
Writers you read. It depends which feminist writers you read. I would say that certainly I understand Carter Haywood's Christology, and there are ways in which I can gravitate towards some dimensions of that. I suppose the point that I'm making is that when I look back at my tradition, when I look back at how black women have dealt with the issue with Jesus of Nazareth, I have to say a little bit more. I have to go, I think, depends on how you look at it, beyond, or some might say go backwards, what has been said in terms of that perspective. Jesus is a brother. Sojourner Truth talked about Jesus as a friend, you know, but Jerina Lee also talked about Jesus as a Lord. You know, so I suppose I can embrace that. I think that there is some dimensions of some points at which we can become reconciled, but I guess I would raise the question as to what does it mean to be reconciled? If by reconciliation you mean total agreement at every theological point, then I would say no. If that were the case, I don't think there'd be the need for womanist perspective in theology. But if by reconciliation you mean that it is possible to develop some working relationships as we move toward this construction of a new humanity, then I think that's very well possible.
It's a real practical question to Dolores. Has Parable of Creation been published? Where can we get a copy?
No, they have not been published. They have not been published.
Well,
they will be. There's a great future coming up.
I'm sure I speak for many of us. We would love a chance to share that way beyond this room. It was beautiful.
It's now 12:25. We're going to ask you to take your valuables with you. This room will not be locked. We'd like you to know that affinity groups are self-generated. There will be no leaders in those groups. We know that there are leaders and powerful people here and that you will find a way to touch and agree. We'd like to have the presenters meet at the presenters' table with the planning committee at lunch for a brief time. Because we don't want to give you indigestion. So we'd like to have all the presenters meet with members of the planning committee at the GSU. Please evacuate at 2:30. We would like to have our two presenters back at 2:30 in order to answer your questions. Please place other questions for panelists in the boxes as you leave. We need your comments and responses on the index cards in order to prepare for our panel discussion about 2:45, 3 o'clock. Thank you.
Yeah, this morning you talk on both of you on womanist theology, and from yesterday we heard about feminist theology. I'd like to know exactly what feminist theology is as opposed to womanist theology.
Well, the first thing I think we have to say is that womanist theology, like feminist theology, will have a distinctive flavor according to whichever womanist is writing the theology. But the differences that I see in womanist theology and feminist theology in terms of where we begin is that there is a difference in the way we define the terms of our oppression, whereas, and we begin at different places, whereas feminist theology, as I see it, begins with a basic critique of patriarchy and defining oppression in terms of women, many of us would ask questions not only about women, but define our oppression in terms of the family, saying that the families of the ruling class families, male, female, and children, have the potential and do exert the potential to oppress non-ruling class families, male, female. And so we begin in a sort of collective. It's, as I said, it would be hard for me as a womanist to begin with the Cartesian formulation, I think, therefore I am. We sort of begin with, we are, therefore I am. But there are tensions in that, and we as black women, many of us struggle for individuation within that kind of masculinization of something, you know, like the blacks, as I mentioned this morning. I think that's one difference. We begin at different places. Also, for me, we define our oppression in a few different ways. We have a unique kind of oppression that I've talked about this morning that must consider a surrogacy as a structure of domination and look at our oppression through that. That's all I got to say. Thank you.
Well, actually, I would say simply what you said, the first point you made in another way. Another way of putting it is that even though in actuality I'm not sure all of what this means, I'm not clear that I'm really precisely sure on how I do this, but I do know what I think needs to be done. And that is, our point of entree is multidimensional. And I would simply say that, by that I mean that the analysis must be multidimensional. That womanist thought begins with the acknowledgement that black women are victimized by virtue of who they are as black women, and most often poor. And therefore, the analysis must be one that addresses all of those issues. And so what I would say is that the womanist doing theology from the experience of black women means that we must take seriously the contradiction of race, gender, as well as class, and I would say any other form of oppression, because I think that oppression, whatever kind it is, tends to affect black and other third world women in a more severe way, just by nature of the racism and the sexism. So I'd say essentially that womanist theology takes seriously black women's religious experiences as a source for doing theology, meaning that we take seriously the contradictions by virtue of race, gender, and class, minimally.
I have a comment that I'd like to make. It's not a question. And that is simply to say to both of you, Dolores and Jacqueline, thank you. Because thank you for your presentations. And to say that as black women, we spend so much time defining who we are not, and we spend so much time being excluded, being rendered invisible, being apologized to, being felt sorry for, that for you to be who you are and present what you are is a gift. And thank you for your scholarship and for your critical thinking and for your imagination and for your research and, most importantly, for your courage. Are you telling me to sit down, Dolores?
No, I'm speaking to you. I haven't seen you since lunch.
One of the questions that is important for us as we consider appropriation of the name womanist, I think as part of our discussion in the community, is in fact, can we appropriate that title? Beginning from my sense of the word is that Alice Walker gave us the word in her definitions or in her review of the book about Rebecca Cox Jackson and then elaborated on it in her introduction to In Search of Our Mother's Gardens and so forth, and has recently talked about it again in an article in Essence magazine. One of the criticisms of the use of that term for Christian women or those of us who find ourselves doing theology is whether or not we can really appropriate that term, given the fact that Alice Walker uses that term in a non-specific way to talk about spirituality, loves herself, and particularly because she uses it to talk about women's capabilities, black women's capabilities, Afro-American women's capabilities, of loving ourselves, which includes doing that in all forms and manifestations, and that falls, particularly that latter definition, falls outside of traditional black women's traditional understandings of Christian theology. Would either one of you want to comment on that? Because I think that that for us, as we all struggle to name ourselves as something that is appropriately ours, such as womanist, where we don't have to put an adjective before it, such as black feminist or black women's liberation theology, etc. We have a word that says who we are without having to add adjectives to it is important. And yet there's this, I think, fairly serious criticism about how do we appropriate a term and a meaning that basically comes outside of our quote-unquote Christian tradition. And I ask you because y'all are working with
to whom
it
is
and
this
we
address?
To both of you. Enough, I'll let you off the hook, Laura. Sorry, Jackie can't take the heat all by herself.
Mm-hmm.
And I ask that question because both of your work and scholarship and your ability to move in our community means so much deeply to us, as Tracy has said.
Jonah, is the question, don't leave, is the question whether or not it is appropriate for us to have appropriated Alice Walker's term because it has in it some kinds of definitive ingredients that are foreign to what black Christians believe?
Yes, women in particular, black women, in terms of it's one thing to say loves the spirit, but we are Christian, and what does that mean if we appropriate a word that Alice Walker doesn't give specificity to in terms of spirit, and in effect, the second category, I believe, in that definition, which has been criticized, is that can we as Christian women appropriate that when we're wrestling when Alice Walker has used that term to talk about black women being able to love ourselves in all capacities, which may even mean same-sex relationships, and therefore, how does that stand up in terms of our tradition as black Christian women and the theology we have heretofore until recently at least left unspoken but was very much part of the culture?
Well, I'll start.
Now can I sit down?
I don't know. You might have to account for yourself. Stand there. No, go on.
Well,
sit down.
I'll come back.
Sit down. Let me say this. First, let me say two things in relation to that. First is, I think we are women, regardless of what kind of religious appellations or names we attach to ourselves. So her definition to me was affirmative of who we are as women, you know, the way we be as women, the roundness, the hospitality, the children, the family. So I would see no problem with that in terms of the appropriation. Now, in terms of the loving ourselves regardless, and that may be same sex, you know, I don't think that we shrink from using a term because it is not congruent with what we traditionally have said we believe as Christians there, because that assumes that there is a righteousness there that does not deserve prophetic criticism. You see, it may be that we use a term like that, womanist, because we want to do some criticism in relation to sexuality in terms of what we believe. We want to use it to raise issues that we need to look at in the black community, and certainly sexuality is one of them. You see what I'm saying? So I wouldn't think, just because it goes afield or cuts across the grain of where we traditionally, as black Christian women have been or conceive of ourselves as being, doesn't mean that we withdraw from using the term, and nor do we want to suggest that where we have been traditionally as women has not contained some, does not contain some seed of error too, We have not been in a perfect place. I mean, nobody is. So I would see the term as allowing. The use of the term, the importance of the use of the term is that it allows certain kinds of things to be talked about theologically that other terms that we might use do not allow us to talk about. For instance, her emphasis upon the family begins with mother-child relationship, mother-daughter relationship, and lifts that up as important to be considered. And that, too, has a certain kinds of theological implications for us. The fact that she begins there is pardon. I see no problem with using the term. I know the critique that has come, and Jacqueline and I both have heard Sheryl Sandberg's paper raised, because I think her critique was that it doesn't say anything about Jesus. But you see, what I think is valuable about her term, I don't think it has to say anything about Jesus. She says something about the Spirit, and the reason that I think that's important for the Black church and Black theology is that it gives us a chance to look into some of the African vestiges that have both that we want to claim as Christians in terms of the way we worship and that we want to claim theologically because of the emphasis in Africa and in African religions upon the work of the Spirit, the ancestor spirits. And then, so that gives us an entree into that. And I think that's important. I think we as womanist theologians will have to be much more broad-based than we have been in terms of the Christian tradition, given the fact that we do have an African heritage that we have to give some accounting for also that we have to begin to try to identify in terms of the parts of that that are important for the ways that we have lived our lives, whether it's as Christian or anybody else. So I think the fact that she mentions love and that it can be same-sex love is good, because it allows us to get into the issue, into the community, in ways that the other names and the other kinds of theology, Black male included, have not allowed us. Now, what I say about that is that is not a critique against Black male theology. It says that Black male theology has done whatever it had to do. Now we as Black women do what we have to do. And part of ours, I think, is to critique and to analyze and look at and put under the microscope the attitudes and understandings that we have of sexuality that might be really in the way of our liberation as a people. So I think it's a great term to use. I don't see a problem. That's how language stays alive and doesn't die. It's that it's appropriated and it's used and it's changed context and it gets different kinds of meaning. So I don't see a problem. Jackie, you want to say something?
Yeah. In an article I wrote once, I quoted Karl Barth, and I appreciated a particular comment, a particular perspective that he held on the church, the theologian in relation to the church. The theologian, it provides a self-test for the church, et cetera. And I basically agree with that, the theologian ought to be accountable to the church. Well, anyway, I quoted this in an article, and someone read it and said to me, "Oh, okay, you Barthian then." I said, no, I just happened to have liked what he said at that particular point. There are some other points at which I detest what he says, and I will say that I do not agree with him at that point. There's a sense in which my feeling about the term womanist is reflected in that comment. There are certain parts of Walker's definition of the term that turns me on. There are other parts that I'm not particularly interested in that do nothing for me, but that's the nature of language. There's a sense in which I think one of the reasons why some people don't write is that once you commend anything to writing, it's out there.
That's right. You've lost control.
And that means that it's subject to be taken by anybody and done with what that person, how that person experiences what you've written. Now, I think the term womanism, I appreciate Alice Walker, womanist, I appreciate Alice Walker for reintroducing us to the term, because she didn't introduce us to it. I think that most black women, I don't know about the white community, so I mean, y'all got to tell me about y'all's community. But in terms of the black community, I mean, when I read that definition, it spoke to me because of my experience.
Mine too.
Uh-huh. I mean, so what Alice Walker did was simply help to recall for us a tradition that, yes, one of the points that Cheryl Sanders make is that it's not such a positive tradition. I mean, so, you know, be womanish is not necessarily something that one would, elevate as a model for black kids. But, you know, black folks are accustomed to turning things upside down. We've turned upside down the concept of blackness. It used to be not a good thing to be black. But we radically revolutionized the term blackness. So it's good to be black. Now we're kind of moving, you know, in another direction, trying to be African Americans. But that's all a part of culture. That's all a part of the movement that culture helps us to make. So that, in a sense, you know, it does help to deal with people's work after they're dead.